Hello, welcome to Relatable. This is your host, Teresa Freeman. Today, we find out about what soft skills are necessary for a career in law enforcement. Our guest, Kevin White, is a lieutenant with the Fairfax County Police Department. How did he transition from selling copiers to an exciting career as a police officer? What are some of the defining moments for him on the force? And what about those speeding ticket quotas? Are those fact or fiction? Listen in to find out. Enjoy this episode.
Being here in person. Love it. I love being able to see people in person.
It's
like,
good to find
I'm kind of sick of Zoom,
yeah.
Actually.
Yeah. So, yeah, I couldn't agree
like,
more.
I'm just really over it. But so I want to welcome Kevin White, and you're a lieutenant with Fairfax County Police Department. Yep. So I'm so excited to have you here. I was telling you, you're my first police officer. We've interviewed a couple of people like associated with law enforcement.
Yeah.
But I'm really excited that you're here. And I appreciate you taking the time.
Absolutely. I'm excited.
And so we're friends. Our kids are friends. And also kind of a funny, like how people are connected story is many years ago when I think we had our third child as a baby, your sister was our nanny and we lived in a different town. And like, it took us a while to even find the connection that you guys are related. So it's just such a small world.
But once it does, like I remember having that conversation and it's like the world just shrunk all of a sudden.
And she would always tell us, you have to meet my brother. You have to hang out with my brother. Like you guys would get along so well.
Yeah,
and then we're living in the same neighborhood.
That's very cool.
So first, I think if we could talk about what a typical day in the life is. I think, you know, one of the things I love to do on the podcast and as I talk to people is to get like the inside scoop.
Yeah.
And so tell me a little bit about, I'm sure each day is a little bit different, but if you were to generalize, you know, tell me a little bit about that.
So, it's best, I think, to talk about what a police officer, maybe not quite somebody who's in my position right now or the rank that I have, because some of those duties change and I'm happy to discuss that. But a police officer, there is truth that no day is the same, right?
Yeah.
And you have to prepare that no day is going to be the same. The role is to serve the community. So in that context, an officer's primary responsibility, particularly the ones that you might see out patrolling around your neighborhood or unfortunately stopping individuals when they're driving, is to respond to calls for service. And so that is a wide variety of things, but it's everything from that emergency where somebody is experiencing a crisis, or it's a lot of times people don't really know who to call. And it took me some time to realize that. And my wife, Kira's family is in law enforcement.
Uh-huh.
And so I've had over the years an opportunity to kind of have a little bit more opportunity to kind of talk about the experiences I've had. And one thing that she always reminded me and it kept me grounded was that people don't know who to call sometimes. And so they call the police. And,
right.
and it might turn out to be a civil matter that is not a criminal matter in any nature. But the police are in many ways expected to kind of identify that and say, you know, what you're experiencing is not something that we would, you know, investigate further and we'll kind of give you the resources. But officers are out there with the goal of deterring crime and catching criminals who are doing it. So an officer drives around and things are a lot different. Even I just hit 20 years a couple of weeks
ago.
So thank you. And
there's
a little more technology in that cruiser than there was even 20 years ago. But the reality is there's a computer in there and officers get dispatched to calls. Their primary responsibility is when somebody calls the police is to go. And it could be a domestic violence call.
Mm-hmm.
It could be a burglary at a residence, or again, it could be something as simple as a dispute between neighbors that, you know, people don't know who to call. And so there's a lot of eating in your car and hoping that, you get that 15 minutes to wolf down that food. Otherwise, you might get called. There's just no 2 days are the same.
And what's the career path like within, I don't know if there's a direct progression, mm-hmm. or is it there are different lanes that you, right? You yes. see a lot on TV about detectives Absolutely. And right. And then, you know, about like you were talking about kind of street police yep. officers. And so is there like a career path that's pretty well known, or does it depend on your interests?
So generally speaking, and you know, being a Fairfax County police officer, I can speak a little bit more to yeah. how that looks in an agency our size. We're a pretty large agency, yeah. But generally speaking, officers are required to do a certain amount of time as a patrol officer, somebody okay. who's working those calls, learning the job, like every profession out there. Mm-hmm. If you're new to it, the expectation is that you have to kind of learn from the bottom up yeah. and what is the foundational, and people will always say, and you'll always hear, and it's so true, that the patrol function of a police department is the backbone of the police department. Mm. The investigations and some of the administrative functions are all very important as well, but what you and I see when I'm driving around, those officers are the doing the bulk of the work day in and day out. So officers typically have to work, you know, 2 to 5 years as a mm-hmm. patrol officer, and that includes nights and days. In our department, there's a set schedule. Fortunately, years ago, you used to have to rotate. So you do 1 month on day work, then 1 month yeah. on midnights, and that's very difficult. And I think the department recognized that and decided that they knew that there had to be some work-life balance. Mm-hmm. It's not a lot when you're in police work anyway, so they kind of were able to structure that a little bit better. But as you become more familiar with the job and you get better at it, when you hit around 5 years, you can start looking towards investigative specialties. So with our police department, there's Major Crimes Bureau, mm-hmm. or it's always changing, different criminal investigation divisions. So they're the ones who might investigate burglaries and, mm-hmm. and robberies, or your more severe crimes like homicides, things of that nature. And so you would process for that. And in law enforcement, police work, you have to essentially interview and take a test, because it's a competitive process against everybody else who wants that position. Mm-hmm. They're at times very sought off after mm-hmm. position. So there's an investigative side. You can go into a special operations if you want to be what most kids do, which is a SWAT officer, you know, one of those that you
yeah,
see.
Yeah, they bang down
call,
the door.
Yeah, they're the cops that the cops call, they like to say. Or, you know, you see those officers on motorcycles. Mm-hmm. That's a highly specialized skill that takes many, many hours of training. That is one thing I've decided very early I would never want to do. Motorcycle's not my thing. But those are specialties. You know, Fairfax County has a helicopter unit. It's the only police department in Northern Virginia that has a helicopter unit. So you could go, and those are medics, actually. So you get to go to school to learn how to be a medic. But then there's also the supervisory route. So if you want to supervise people and go into leadership and management, at about that same time frame, you can start processing to become a sergeant, a lieutenant, and so on, and kind of go up the ranks into, you know, what feels right for you, and supervise. So those are your options.
Did you always know that you wanted to be a police officer?
No, I didn't know until probably 6 months before I applied to the job. So the interesting, so I came from a family of public servants. My mom and dad were both federal government employees. We traveled overseas. We lived on bases, and so I had a connection with some sort of civil service and public service. And as I entered college, I really just assumed my dad would get me a job with the government. I'm not right? Like he told me military or college, and I was at the time afraid of the military. I was like, I don't know if mm-hmm. I could handle, and that just I don't know if he did that intentionally to push me to college or not. He was in the Army early in his life. So I started going to college, and then unfortunately, in my second year, my dad passed away.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah, and so I didn't really have a plan. I assumed again that, you know, I would be filling out an application for a government job in my third year, and you know, he was gonna help with that, and I didn't really kind of know what I wanted to do after that. And so I graduated. I knew I wanted to get out of school within 4 years, and I graduated, and really didn't have.
What was your degree?
Passion. It was in electronic media, so communications. Huh. And yeah, I had a uncle who was a director, a news director out in Colorado, an affiliate of NBC out there. And so he's very interesting, and my uncle is an incredibly interesting guy and awesome. And so I really didn't know, and he and I talked, and it sounded like something I would be interested in, but it really didn't manifest. I realized after that probably wasn't something I wanted to do. So just entered the workforce. I got into sales is where I was right out of college, selling copiers door to door, outdoor sales. I mean, very difficult.
Brutal.
Yes, brutal. And then... I knew that was not the path, but I really didn't have much going in. And so I bounced around a couple different sales positions, ended up in the late 1990s in the dot-com world.
Mm-hmm.
Right? We live in an area that was very popular, and I was in sales, and you know, it actually wasn't, it was rewarding financially,
yeah.
Right? I mean, the money was coming in, and as a young kid right out of college, it was good in some ways, but it didn't take long for me to realize that I didn't really have much passion there. I didn't come home every day and really feel good about mm-hmm. what I was doing.
Right.
And it's hard, you know, you learn quickly that unless you're selling something that you put together, you did,
yeah.
it lacked the passion. So I basically met my wife, girlfriend at the time, and her brother was a New York City police officer. Her dad was a New York City police officer. Several conversations later, just talking with them and learned that they had a strong passion for their job, and knew I wanted to kind of redirect back into public service, and I wasn't sure what I wanted to do. Talked with them, found what they were saying very interesting, and then I said, let's do this. I applied to the Fairfax County Police Department. A massive change. 28 years old at the time. So weren't
Is that
married
old?
Yet.
Is that pretty old to start?
It's, you know, it's probably right at the
yeah.
the higher end.
Mm-hmm.
Most who do know what they want to do, and you'd be surprised, so many people do know they want to be a police officer when they, you know, they're 15, 16,
yeah.
17. So right at 21 years old, they're in, because at 21, you can enter the academy. In fact, you can enter the academy at 20 as long as you graduate by the time you're 21. So there are folks who know right away that they go in. So in my academy class, I was probably one of the older ones, but still relatively young.
Yeah.
There are some that were a little bit older. So big career change, a little nervous. I kept it very close because I was nervous about not succeeding. And,
right.
and the academy is a very tough place, and people get fired or
like they're weeded out.
Yeah, weeded out, and it's a very. I was extremely anxious during that time, and
yeah.
I know my recruits that were with me, the 22 year olds who were like, oh, this is nothing, this is what I'm doing, and I'm like, you don't understand, like
yeah.
I've got everything riding on this. So yeah, that's how it happened, and I haven't looked back. I mean, I have found what has really been one of the most the best decisions I've ever
wow.
made. It's and the work is so rewarding.
Would you say from the academy, just to give us an inside look there, like from a I'm interested in two things,
yeah.
like the physical aspect
mm-hmm.
and how difficult that is,
yeah.
just in terms of what you have to be able to do physically, and then so we'll start there. Tell
yeah.
me a little bit about
so,
that part.
So as part of the hiring process, there's a obstacle course that you have to complete in so many minutes, and it involves dragging somewhere around 180 pound body or. Not body, a dummy, I guess. You know, a certain
yeah.
distance you have to run. You have to simulate what you're kind of doing throughout the a day in the life
mm-hmm.
of. So it's scaling a wall or a fence, and it's kind of remembering certain things. And so even to just pass that in the time frame it takes, you have to show that you have some physical
mm-hmm.
Stamina and abilities. And then when you get in the academy, there is a very regimented and structured wellness you know, regimen that you
yeah.
go through. And so you're working out almost every day. You're either doing defensive tactics. So you're ground fighting and you're doing those things. And then, or you're running every day and working out. And, you know, our police department has just embraced the wellness aspect of things. And we have a ton of resources. So we have a very large gym and all of the newer, everything from jiu-jitsu and,
mm-hmm.
and some of this ground fighting that is very popular nowadays.
That's
and
cool.
MMA is all incorporated into the wellness and
oh,
fitness.
That's cool.
So the standards are broad, I'll say, because we still have to adhere in many ways to the DCJS, Department of Criminal Justice Services, Virginia's DCJS. And so the requirements kind of are a broad spectrum, but we try to narrow that
in terms
down
of,
and
yeah.
keeping them, yeah.
And then what about the intellectual side of it in terms of law, the actual laws that you need to know and the, I guess, the written test?
Yeah, so first, to become a police officer, you have to have a high school degree still, and you used to take a test. So I had to take a test to be accepted or to take the next step in the hiring process. But when you're in the academy, there are KSAs, knowledge, skills, and abilities, mm-hmm. that you have to meet, and the state mandates X number of data points that you have to know, and they are everything from law, you know, your typical search and seizure law and all of the case law and things like that. And then the police department incorporates a certain number of them as well. And so there used to be spelling tests even on it. They just, you know, I mean, spell misdemeanor or spell some of those things, your mind will go. So there's a total number that the state requires that you have to know and pass. And there's in the academy, there's three strikes and you're out, essentially. So if you miss a required testing mm-hmm. point, you have a second attempt to pass that. And if you don't pass it on the third attempt, you have to leave. I think they allow you to, you know, reapply after a year or something mm-hmm. like that. But then there's also driving. I mean, there's a driving test. And in Fairfax County, we have a track that we own. And so you do many, many hours on a course, and you have to complete and pass that test as well. And then, of course, firearms.
Yeah,
do that.
Is that fun, the driving side?
Yeah, that was
to have your own.
To be able to push the limits on somebody else's dollar, and and just the learning aspect. I mean, you don't know what your limits are until you reach them, and so in this line of work and in that type of environment too, it's what's so cool about it to be paid, and part of your job is to kind of test your own limits and test the limits of it's. Scary at times.
You
cross that line occasionally and you end up crashing a car or something like
right.
that. But you need to do that to know how far you can go.
That's an interesting thing about, you know, as you're talking about it, and I think about like confidence and your, you know, to go into the academy and feeling like you mentioned like you were nervous, which I appreciate because maybe not a lot of people would admit that. And as a guy, right? So like from a confidence perspective, do you feel like the way that you're within the academy and then the way that you're evolve and grow, the confidence comes from the experience that you have? So if you're not entirely confident or you don't feel like you're maybe like a badass dude that can like go, or gal, right?
Yeah.
That's like, I suspect that maybe that gets cultivated when you're part of the recruit class, and then as you go
through,
exactly they train you to be that way, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, you do have to have a certain level of confidence. And I knew this is what I wanted to do. I mean, this was not at that point. While I didn't know it early on, I had kind of decided that this is that part of the public service, that civil service job, that giving back to the community that I wanted to do. And so I had all the confidence in the world with that. You know, they make it very clear that if you don't pass this test, you will be gone. And so that's a certain level of that anxiety they give you. But they do such a good job of exposing you to those things that you're going to experience in the real life situation, that if you don't have that in your toolbox, if you haven't been punched in the face before, let's be honest, right? In the academy, you are, there are recruits who go there. They've never gotten in a fight before, and that's okay. But it better you learn what it feels like to fight in a very intense moment in the academy than it does when you're trying to arrest somebody on the street. And that's both a physical component, but also the mental component. There's everything that has to do with, you know, de-escalation and all of the things mm-hmm. we read about now. Like, you have got to be able to, and I know we'll talk about it later, but communication is key, and you have to be able to talk to people, and you have to be able to de-escalate or escalate things as necessary. And it's a very, very quick thing that you have to be able to kind of assess the situation. So practical exercises, all of those things happen in the academy. We have something called a practical alley, where it's a mock-up of a bank and a bar and all of these things.
So
and
cool.
You walk into that and you're like thrust in, and you've responded, and here you are, never having ever responded to a call before. And so you get to make those mistakes in an environment that allows you to learn from them. And so you grow out of that, for sure.
How much fear do you have? I mean, you've done it for 20 years now, so you have a good clip under your belt. And obviously, you know, there's what we see in terms of what you're up against in your role. By the way, I should have said in the beginning, thank you so much for your service. Oh, I should have said it out of the gate. I have such great respect for law enforcement and firefighters and everybody that's kind of protecting and serving us all the time. How does is the fear something in like your conscious state, right? Or is it like once you kind of go to work every day, do you have to compartmentalize? Like, tell me a little bit about like that aspect of it, because you are putting yourself on the line and you're, you know, you just don't know. There's things that are out of your control.
I think that the way I've approached it is I've made the decision. Nobody forced me to be a police officer. And so I'll share a quick story. When I was in my field training period, so after you graduate the academy, you go and you do roughly 3 months with a field training instructor. And so there's somebody who's there with you every day, observing you and debriefing you at the end of the night and saying, this is what you do well and this is what you didn't. And you have to kind of pass that period as well. But there was a call, a domestic violence call, and part of learning the process is learning where you have to go. So you're trying to navigate the streets before GPS, and we had a map book. I encourage everybody to learn how to read a map at some point, so we don't rely on our iPhones or phones. But we get to the location, which was an apartment building, and I watched another who I didn't even realize at the time was my sergeant, who ran into the apartment, and I just jumped out of the car and I ran in there after, and I didn't really know why or what I was doing, and we ended up arresting an individual, and I think there was a knife involved and a few other things. But afterwards, my FTI asked, why did you run in there? Like, you didn't know what you... And I said, well, I ran in because he ran in. And he said, good answer. And it was a very old school way of thinking, but I didn't consider. I knew my job was to go in there to assist that officer. Mm-hmm. And that's just a small example of how I've approached it. Every day you go to work, you've made the commitment to yourself. And there's so much truth in when you hear about the camaraderie among officers, and you're not just doing the job because you want to do it. You're there for your partners. And I spent 6 years on a very close team, mm-hmm. where it was only six of us, and we spent every night going out working together. And so you have a kind of obligation to that too. And so I think it really never entered. It kind of just got put in the back, and it said, this is a commitment I've made. That's not to say there haven't been moments where you're doing certain things, searching a home, you know, and you don't know what's around the corner. I mean, you definitely do need to kind of harness those moments and recognize that there's the unknown, but you do... Sounds cliche, but you stick to your training and you say, I've been told how to do this. And what I find incredible just about how we work as your brain works, or your mind, you revert to your training. I don't know how often people can say that, but in our line of work, I can't tell you how many times I've been put in a situation. And then after that's over, I look back on my reaction because I didn't process how I was reacting at the moment.
Yeah.
I go, man, that's exactly how they trained me to do that. And I didn't take a moment to go, what did they teach me at my in-service or the academy? I just, that's what I did. And so you stick to that. And
it's like athletes too, right? When like all that conditioning and like when the big moment happens, you're like, you've just done so much practice, so many repetitions that it's that muscle memory.
The muscle memory kicks in. Yeah. And it's important. So over the years, you have to continue to train and continue to go through these in service, we call it that kind of career development. But the fear, I think you are committed to your job and you're deciding to do it. Nobody's making you do it. And it makes it a little bit easier to go into that situation.
Yeah. I remember the first time we met, we were on a field trip, mm-hmm. and just like we are now, I was asking you like a million questions. Yeah. And one of the things, it was actually when we met, I know there was, I can't even remember now because now there have been so many events, but one of the things we talked about was the, you know, difficulty of like, you've chosen a career in which you're serving and you're a public servant. And yet there's a lot of, I don't even know if controversy is the right word, but there's a lot of press, I'd say, or there's a lot of like opinion on your profession and whether, you know, you're, you know, as a unit of people are doing things in the right way and appropriately. And I'm curious from your perspective, like how much of a factor does that, like how much does that impact you? You know, does that make it difficult? You know, it's like, here you are kind of putting yourself out there every day on our behalf, and then to hear all the kind of negative commentary.
Realatable is sponsored by TFA Soft Skills, your one-stop shop for workshops, coaching, speaking, and soft skills development. If you'd like to hire Teresa, visit www.tfasoftskills.com for more information.
It can be difficult at times, and it's a lot of times I think we as a profession, we look at those moments and we shake our heads at times, you know, and that's not all of them. And we have in our line of work, and particularly as a police officer, one of the reasons I think we bring so much value to situations that, when we're called to the scene of something or we are investigating something, we're generally an objective viewpoint on that. We're not invested in that dispute. We're not invested in that crime. So the public can trust us to make a decision that's not based on any preconceived bias we have or anything like that. So sometimes we try to give that benefit of the doubt to those in our own profession. So when something happens and it hits and it's scrutinized, I think a lot of times we recognize that we often say three sides to every story. Mm-hmm. There's person A, person B, and somewhere the truth is in there somewhere. Yeah. And so there are times when I think we shouldn't, though, be quick to just try to defend or, it's okay to say, I have a problem with that too, or I can see how that, incident that is in the press, or I can see how that would make you feel. And there's times we just put our heads down and shake it too and go, you know, what I try to encourage or remind people is that we are human too, you know, and there are, I think, over 700,000 police officers in the United States. And so it is hard expect, perfection. But I think we know, just like any other profession, you may come in contact with a police officer today and you may not have contact with another one for years. Or it might be the only time you ever do. And one thing we try to remind people is that what you take away from that is what you're going to share with everybody. And that's the experience you're going to take with you. And so that's tough because we are seeing people in very difficult moments in their life. And we have to do very difficult things sometimes, things that we know are not going to make you happy or those around you. And so how we deal with those and how we leave the person is so important because that's going to drive their perception. And perception is reality. And, I try not to make excuses when they shouldn't be made. And I try to kind of leave people on the experience they have with me and hope but we're true to that. What we're doing is so important that I don't think you'll find many officers get deterred by the negative kind of moments in what we're seeing.
And I think also it's important to remember that, like everything, if you're only seeing a handful or, over the years, you see these specific moments and you don't see all the good, right? I think it's like anything in any profession where it's like, I'm an HR person. There's a lot of thankless work in HR life. And so, you're sort of boiled down to one thing when really you're so much more than that in terms of the career. So I think it's that balance and that view of like, this is not everybody. It's not like, just because there's an incident, it doesn't mean you're all like that. It's like, and to have that many, obviously that's a microcosm of like a country, in terms of, so you're going to have that, when you talk about 700,000 people, you're going to have variants.
And it is so important though, that the public and those that we're serving are do trust in our ability to hold people accountable and trust that we're doing the right thing. I mean, that is this very pivotal and very kind of...
without that, you can't do your job.
And so we have to maintain that. Like, that has to be something that when we go out and we do our job, it is a disservice to our community if we are not reminding ourselves that there's so much trust. I'll give you the perfect example. This is a judge told this to a group. I was in court early on in my career, and it was traffic court, and a judge this has resonated with me. The judge told, in traffic court generally, you don't have a defense attorney, right? So if you don't like the ticket you got, you'll stand up and you'll say, Your Honor, and then I will proffer my probable cause and why I did what I did, and you can ask me questions. But the judge was very clear to this courtroom that what the police officer says, the judge is going to trust. That's the level of trust we put in. If I say that Teresa Freeman was speeding today, and I go and stand before a judge and tell them that you were speeding, the judge is going to believe me. I don't have to provide evidence because maybe I was pacing you, right? And there's no physical description to show that you were speeding. There's body-worn camera and things like now. But that level of trust that I can go into a court, if I abuse that trust, if I say that you were speeding and you weren't, and I know that judge is going to believe me because that's the level of trust that the community has put in me. That's a small example. That's the worst you're going to pay is a fine there. But, right. But there's so much the community, I have put into the police officers that are working, that if we violate that trust and we abuse that trust, it is so hard to get back, right? We know that. Our children, we tell them, I can't trust you. You've lied to me. And I encourage all of the officers that work for me and everybody that works for me that they have to recognize that, because it is such a big amount of trust that's put on, such a level of trust and that they have. If you abuse that, it's so interesting
because it, funny enough, it translates to corporate America, because I think without trust, you can't effectively run an organization. You can't effectively drive performance. You can't effectively do what you need to do to support people in their career and growth. So it's so interesting because I think it's such an anchor for so many things in order for them to work and to do the right thing. Tell me a little bit about the balance between, I did source some questions before because it's such an interesting profession, but tell me a little bit about the balance between kind of, wearing the badge and being in that role and then, hanging it up for the night or the day and like kind of switching that on and off. Is it sort of like, are you always, are you sort of cop first and like that is sort of in you now, or can you kind of, when you're off,
So I think over the years I've been able to balance that, early on you're it's an exciting job. I mean, let's be honest, right? Yeah. And it is, there are things that you get to do and participate in that are exciting. And I mean, you come home and you're just
like adrenaline.
Like, this was, and so you're like, you just want to be a police officer, all day long. And then as time goes on, and I think that I can be at times, a little in public, I'm probably a little more guarded, than the general person or even my wife or so. I think I've been able to kind of balance when it's important to kind of turn that on or be in that mode. But it's hard. I am one of, I wouldn't say few, but a lot of the police officers in Fairfax don't live in Fairfax County. So when they're outside of Fairfax, jurisdiction, they don't have law enforcement power in the same way I do right now. So I'm in the county, I can, take action, which again makes it a little bit more kind of something I'm aware of at all times. We went out to dinner last night, and so if I'm eating dinner in Fairfax County, I'm not saying that the department always expects me to do something, but I have, I believe,
duty to act,
and I want to make sure that not just my family but those around are. So if I hear a dispute getting a little bit louder when we're at the mall or somewhere, I kind of like pause and my wife's like, come on, can we go? And I'm not injecting myself. Like, that's, again, one thing over the years. You kind of learn what's important and what's not. Or, they always say it's important to be a good witness. You don't always have to jump in. So early on, it's difficult. And I think in part because you're like this. I'll never forget. When you get that badge pinned on, when you take the oath, even at 28 years old, and I think I bring a lot of, at that time, I think I brought a lot of good things to a patrol capacity because I saw more things than a 22-year-old police officer. I am in constant awe of some of these officers who come in at 21 and 22 years old and the way they're able to conduct themselves. the feeling I got at 28 years old when they gave me a gun and a badge, I thought if I were 21, I don't know. Like yeah. that there's yeah. you there's a you like know you
that
feel,
frontal lobe is still developing.
Yes, yes,
yeah.
And you're empowered with a lot of authority. And
yeah.
I mean, I think I looked and I said, man, it was a good thing that I sold copiers for a year or so.
Yeah.
And before I became a police officer. And so, you know, some mistakes are made, very few by young officers. But I will tell you that those that do know what they want to do and when they go in at 22, it's pretty impressive because if you gave me that,
yeah,
that level of authority at 21.
What's your favorite, if you could like pin it down, what's your favorite thing about being in this profession? Like, what do you like the most about it?
Early on, I would have said that I just love arresting and getting, you know,
getting the bad people.
Yeah. When so after a couple of years, and I mentioned that kind of 5 year, I never came into this expecting to go into kind of a supervisory position. It didn't really enter my headspace until about 12 to 15 years on. I was having so much fun. And so after the first 4 years, I was on a neighborhood patrol unit, they call it like a selective enforcement team in our district, where we, six of us, were assigned quality of life issues. So we would investigate possible drug dealing in your mm-hmm. neighborhood, or just really issues that the community was experiencing. And so we were able to go out and proactively do criminal interdiction. And so while I told you many of those officers are responding to calls for service and they're just going from one call to the next mm-hmm. call and then hopefully having time to write the report, we were able to go out and make proactive arrests. And so that was, every day was exciting because we were investigating people, long-term, short-term investigations, and we were you know, writing search warrants and all of these things, which was just, I mean, that was the most fun in my career.
Yeah.
I think most people say once they start reaching supervision, you better have a different definition of what fun is. And so that
yeah.
is exciting. But I will say what really just beats that out by a little bit, and I am kind of a guy who thinks the world is still good, and,
yeah.
and I'm a half glass
yeah.
full kind of guy. And it was really just the way people responded when you were able to help them.
Ah,
like that was, you know,
yeah. there's
all of that fun and all of the cool reasons why you get to drive fast and pursue people and arrest people. All of those things are what, you know, you come home and you're like, man, that was an adrenaline rush. That was exciting. And I helped take drugs off the street, or I helped to get this person who just committed a robbery, you know, in custody. But to me, it was more, you know, when there was a call I went to where a teenage boy had a knife and he was going to kill him. He was threatening to kill himself, and he had a knife in his bedroom, and you know, you walk in that situation and everybody's on edge. And fortunately, and there were a couple young officers in front who were really like, you know, they were in that use of force mode, like, he's got a knife, what do I do?
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so I weaseled my way up to the front and really just sat and talked to this young kid for 10 or 15 minutes until he finally put the knife down. And, you know, we were able to kind of get him the services he want. It was the parents afterwards. And having
yeah.
a child, having kids now, like, you understand how impactful that is. And they pull you aside and they appreciate and they thank you. And so when you're helping people in a crisis, and
yeah.
when you're able to, without having to arrest anybody, without there being, you know, this big event occur, there are times when you just get to walk away from that and you did what you
yeah.
went in this line of work to do, which is to help people in those moments where they're experiencing very difficult times. And so it could be as simple as, you know, folks write a letter saying thank you. It's those moments, quite frankly, that I will take with
yeah.
me after
yeah.
this career.
One of the things I think is interesting is, I mean, maybe within the context of your career, but it certainly could be else, it doesn't have to be in that context, is just I'm interested in how people kind of pivot and maneuver through their life, right? And for you, what I think is so interesting is that 28, like you talked about being kind of a later, you know, kind of try, you know, going to school, trying something, and
yeah.
then being like, yeah. Because so I love that it's not this like straight line, because I think
yeah.
a lot of us, it's not. And there's maybe a misnomer out there that like everybody knows what they want to do. And then
right.
for those of us that don't or are confused or took a minute, it's like, hey, that's okay. Because
yeah.
there's a lot of stories to back that up. For you, if you think about either a significant moment or a person, maybe a mentor, anything that like has really shaped you or kind of kept you on a path or, you know, made such a like a shape-shifting moment, yeah, right? Yeah. Where you're like either that made a significant impact on you. Can you talk about that?
We are busy scheduling relatable interviews for 2023, and we love our relatable community. If you or someone you know would be a good guest for Relatable, let us know. You can send an email to info@tfasoftskills.com. Include the potential guest name and contact information. Please send all suggestions to info@tfasoftskills.com.
Yeah, absolutely. There was you probably remember life before children. It's a way for us. It's now for me. It's 13 years.
Yeah.
And life before you have a kid, as everybody knows, is much different than the moment that child's born. Right. Yeah. So you're the way you approach a date, just the risks you take are much different, and how you prioritize things become much different. And you know, I remember there was a Patrick, my 13-year-old, was just born, so this was 12 years ago, I guess. He might have been 1 or 2 years old at the time. And while, again, I told you I was on this specialty team, that we really weren't responding to calls, but of course, if something, an emergency comes out and you're close to it, you're going to respond to it. And so a call came out that I think it was a 3-month baby had stopped breathing at a home daycare. And so we all responded to this. Now there's 6, you know, of us, and we're all kind of in the same stages of our life. So a couple of them have kids too, and very, very young children. And so we responded, and unfortunately the baby didn't survive. And you know, we were right there. I mean, providing CPR and some of those really hands-on moment. And I'll never forget, we meeting the team once, you know, rescue shows up, fire and rescue in Fairfax County, you know, they're much better. We just happened to be there first. And I'll never forget walking, kind of pacing up and down the street. And I was on one side of the street. My partner was on the other side of the street. Another guy on our team was kind of another 30 feet up. We're not talking to each other. We're just pacing back and forth. And like we're thinking like, this is hitting home. This is really like, it's different now. And I had been to calls like that before you have kids. And it's different. You just don't understand how important that is. And I bring that story up because it reminds me of how all of the other things in life, in the end, don't really matter, right? Mm-hmm. Like the material things. And I mean, I say that, of course, you know, we all subjected to that and we all kind of give into it. But in the end, life is so precious. And when you have an opportunity or you have people around you, that's who is the most important and should be the most important things. And it was just that moment that was of clarity to me of how fragile life can be, mm-hmm. and how, you know, it can be taken from us or, you know, at any moment. And, you know, I mentioned my dad passed away, and while that was a significant moment, you know, something like this really reminded me of what is important in life, and able to kind of
prioritize. And it didn't deter you. Like, you didn't think like, oh my gosh, I can't. Because one of the things that, you know, maybe because we talked about the best thing, like sort of the underbelly part of of all the hard things that you have to see and you can't unsee.
Yeah.
I interviewed a really good friend of mine who eventually got her MSW, and she started her career in news, just sort of fell in and was like somehow became like a segment producer. She's in New Mexico. And she talked about like, I couldn't do it because there's just so much. Her first day on the job, a teacher this was years and years ago before kind of more of the shooting stuff that's been happening, but a teacher was shot and she was in like a parking lot. Mm. And she was told, I think she was editing, and she was told like, we don't want to see the body, you know, so like, but we need you to edit the footage. Yeah. And my friend was like, all that's there is the body, you know, so it's like, and she said this was happening so much that like eventually she's like, I just am too, not the right person to be able to kind of absorb all of that and process it. So is that, I shouldn't speak for you, but is that the hard part of the job, or what would you say is sort of the challenging part?
Yeah, that's, I mean, there's those moments like that, that, you know, I don't know why it doesn't, or why you continue to do it. You know, I've had to provide death notifications mm-hmm. to to a parent whose son died driving home from college. You know, you get a call from a Maryland jurisdiction where they're telling you that this young man died, and now you have to go tell their parent. Like, those are very difficult moments, and I don't know if that's part of the job, and you do it, but I think one of the things I'm able to have, and of course you have to have, most people should have it regardless, but in law enforcement, is empathy, and you have to show that empathy. You have to have it. I mean, if you don't, you're just not going to be successful in the job. And so, you almost kind of take an approach as well. It's like, I'm here to help this person. I'm here to share this very terrible news and inform them in a very kind of, this is my job as a police officer, I have to inform you this, but we are not going to leave you to just take this information. I'm here as long as you need me. This is real for me as it is for you. And I think that, that desire to help people get through that moment, not just to share that information. But I mean, early in my career, I always tried to see the good in people. And I think sometimes people are like, dude, you need to be a little more suspicious of these people, right?
Yeah.
And so you kind of learn that. But I think that most of what we see, even if it's moments like that, or if it's moments where criminals who are doing things, I think the ability to separate the person from the crime is important, because
the backstory, right? You just never know.
You never know where people will share some of the most interesting things. And, I've arrested people committing burglaries because they're addicted to a drug. And you spend time with them, and if you're able to communicate with them and talk with them, you will hear a story that it'll shake you to your core. And you then can remember that while it's important, I have to do this. You've committed a crime. You've victimized somebody. But there's a person here who's got their own story. And if you don't show them that respect and allow them to share that story if they want to, then I think you're really missing an opportunity.
Yeah, and I think what's so great about, as you're talking about this, just the idea of protect and serve, and that really, at the heart of what you all do is to help people and is to be a resource and to be, to help people feel safe and protected. And then I think the other thing, as you were talking about that, it's like, given your training and your background, like, you are kind of the vessel to impart that information. Mm-hmm. And maybe you're the best person given, what you have to do there. So I think I love the way you talk about it, and with the intention that you talk about it, and how it's such a critical moment for someone, and that it seems, you're well aware of that. And that's part of how you're, trained and educated in the...
And a lot of that credit does go to the police department I work for. I mean, the training. And, law enforcement has evolved over time, right? I mean, this softer side of police work, I don't know that, there might be some older generations who are can't even relate to what I'm saying now.
Right.
And so I think but that's important, right? It's important for law enforcement and for kind of that public safety world to evolve. And there are services and things that are happening now to recognize, how we can help people. And in our own profession, and this would be could be a completely different interview or discussion, but, our own profession sees high rate of suicide and things of that, and so the profession again has recognized it. Probably took way too many years for it to pick up on the fact that there's a high suicide rate within law enforcement, and Fairfax County and other jurisdictions are very forward leaning on that and finding ways to provide services to these officers who are hurting and suffering, and there are some really amazing success stories that come out of it. People who are on the verge of doing something, and these services coming in and helping them. So that is an example of just how we're helping ourselves, but also how the community is benefiting from us recognizing as a profession that there's you know, there's it's it can be grayer at times than just a crime and an arrest and then the justice process. So
that's love that. I think hopefully it's happening everywhere in terms of impact of people that have these, you know, all the healthcare workers during COVID, right?
Absolutely,
and then you know, people in public service, and you know, when you're someone that's sort of the enforcer of whatever, you know, that care and feeding for those people is so important, and like keeping them healthy, you know, and what are those things that help them to sort of sustain so that they can be their best selves when they need to
Absolutely.
Be on. One of the things you alluded to, which is actually something else I wanted to ask you, is just in terms of going into situations, you said that people tease you, like, be more suspicious. So if you're in a situation, is it hard to assume positive intent with respect to what's going on? I mean, is there a sequencing of things that you think through to assess a situation to understand, you know, what's versus like that adrenaline you running in the building, right? Like, I would think that kind of fight or flight versus like the rational, like, how do I make sure that what's happening here is really happening?
Yeah, well, so there are certain things that we pick up on quickly or we try to assess. And, you know, short of somebody being hurt,
like an acute,
right, if there's active violence occurring, like, we have to take action. But one thing we learned quickly in just general in our line of work is, like, there's a term that I use often, just hold what you got, right? So meaning if you enter a scene of something chaotic or if it's not, you know, if there's not something happening where you immediately have to take action, then you kind of hold what you got and figure out what's happening. There's time is on your side, and you don't have to rush to a quick judgment or rush to something. And so once you're able to stabilize something, that's as simple as two people yelling at each other, right? I mean, it doesn't have to be a massive event. And so as you start to kind of stabilize that and process what's happening, again, I think going back to just talking about there's always something behind what you're seeing, and there's something. And so, you know, recognizing or doing your best to recognize whether what you're witnessing is what you're being told is happening, and coming to your own conclusion and recognizing that what you see may not be exactly what's happening and or what the motives are behind it. You kind of peel it back, you know, the layers, and kind of figure out what it is.
And
you learn over time, you know, there's indicators that are quick to identify certain things, but I think it is important for everybody to slow it down, we say, and stabilize, and then now kind of just...
I think, too, that you know, in other ways, in other professions, like, it's not as high stakes if you make a mistake, right? If your judgment's not right on. Yeah. And I feel like for you all, like, the margin of error is a lot less. And so the idea of, like, your instincts or what it's so high stakes that you kind of have to make a call in a moment and maybe, you know.
Yeah, there's, as we discussed earlier regarding kind of what's happening or what's happened in the news and things like that, there's always been an understanding, and this goes to case law all the way up to the Supreme Court, that, you know, officers are doing the best they can in the moment they have.
Right.
But the accountability is there, and you know, I think it's important that we get it right as often as we can. But you know, sometimes those the inputs, you know, are you're reading what you're observing and seeing, and it's not always what is happening either.
Yeah.
And that's just the unfortunate.
All right, two quick other questions. One about speed traps.
Yes.
And quotas.
Yes.
Totally. I wanted to ask you, are there quotas? Because everyone says that we see a lot more activity in the end of the month.
Yeah,
and
no, that's a complete perception. I mean, there are no quotas.
Okay, that's good to know.
Absolutely none. Yeah, there's none. I mean, you know, police work is going to involve certain things, but it's there's not a, and that's from the top down. There's no expectation that you are writing tickets. Yes.
And then the other thing I just thought of as you were talking, which is kind of random. How about, have you had to throughout your career, or is it something that, like, being having to testify? So you talked about, like, being up in traffic court, and that's one thing.
Yes.
But presumably, like, the further involved you get in some of this work, like, you are someone that's, you know, going to have to get up and testify one way or the other. Yeah. Have you had to do that a fair amount?
Yeah, absolutely. And been crossed by defense attorneys.
And
You know, so real quick, I know we don't have a lot of time, but, you know, a police officer is a witness, essentially. After the charges happened and after it goes to court and the prosecutor's there, you become a witness. And so what is very important, and I'll share a quick story that my brother-in-law, when I was talking about police work, and at 28, the one thing you realize is you know that not everything is good, right? So when you ask somebody, hey, what do you do your job or what's good, they're going to tell you the great things. You better realize there's some negative things to your job. And he told me very candidly, you're going to see people in the worst times of their life. And I okay, got it, good. He did not tell me the level of paperwork involved in law enforcement and documentation. I'm like, and this is back when we used to handwrite stuff. And I go, geez, man, I wish you would at least prepare me that I was writing dissertations for my reports. But documenting is key and really preparing yourself for court, right? Because you may not go to court for 6, 8 months, a year later, and now you're relied to talk about what it was. So it's all about preparation. And in our line of work, we are documenting everything. We will write a report saying we're writing a report. You know what I mean? And so you really just have to be prepared. And then when you go, you know, it's one of those things that experience will help you. Yeah. You know, but you're up there to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
Right.
And so you're messaging it the way you can, and you let the attorneys
duke it out. And I think too, you're obviously, I'm guessing, skilled at interviewing. So, you know, at some point, right? So then that's got to be a factor too, is like you're up there on the receiving end. You know, it's all kind of
But you are. It is. You're kind of processing that as well. I will tell you, you're able to. One thing you have to be able to do too is allow the courts and the rest of that criminal justice process to take place without being frustrated. I'll never forget. I charged somebody with something and it didn't hold up in court. The person was found not guilty, and I walked out of there. I couldn't have been more upset. I'm like, oh my gosh, how dare that judge not?
Right.
And my FTI was still my FTI period, so he's like, look, this is one of many times that you know, because there's mitigating circumstances, and so you have to do your job, which is to, you know, you have a job of finding probable cause, arresting an individual, and process and document it best you can. But what happens after that is not in your control. Yeah. And that was a tough one to get over. It wasn't even that big of an offense. And looking back on it, you know, it's...
Because
it's
you're like, if you're someone with integrity...
Yes,
I
wouldn't say it, Your Honor, if it didn't happen. And right. It did happen. It's just that judges have discretion, too, as to whether they're going to,
apply the...
It's something I try to remind new officers, like, you're going to experience wins and losses, like in sports. And if you're not able to adjust to that, you're going to have some sort of trouble.
Let's pivot and talk a little bit about soft skills. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And as I think you know, I'm a super passionate. And with respect to law enforcement and your role, what do you think are one or two that are really important to be successful in that profession?
The first one that comes to mind is teamwork. And knowing your role within a team and contributing to a team, whether it's a small 5-person, 6-person team or a multi-thousand person organization, that, you know, we all have a role to play, and understanding kind of where you fit in and your commitment to that team and your commitment to the people that you're working with and for, and you know, ensuring that you're doing what you need to do to make that team successful. And in my line of work, it's, you know,
like, you're all,
the stakes can be higher, and we got each other's back. But also communication, you know, just being able to articulate. That's another very popular word in my line of work, is articulation. And why did you do something? You can't just say, because I thought I should. You have to articulate why you did something or why you didn't do something. And so as you translate that across anything, I use that on my kids a lot. I'll ask them, you know, to articulate, explain to me what you were thinking and why you were doing it. Because you're going to be able to message. You're going to be able to provide your message in a clear and concise way, and one that supports your decision for why you did it. We aren't always going to make the right decision. You just try to make the best informed decision you can with the information you have, but, you know, not getting trapped by just answering and not really be able to kind of explain. And that, in my line of work, you know, communication is everything. You know, you need to be able to escalate and de-escalate and you know, talk to people all day, every day. Mm-hmm. And you know, any profession you're in. I was in sales and I was trying to talk to people, and I'm in this line of work and I'm talking to people. And in HR, you're, you know, communicating with inside and outside the organization. Right. And so, yeah, I find that to be one of the most important.
I think the thing too that you mentioned, which I really like, is the, you know, connecting dots of, to your point around why you did something or why you didn't do something, and almost the reasoning, the like logical reasoning that takes place, and then being able to frame that and translate that to someone else, especially in what you do, I would think really sets you apart in terms of that career director trajectory or being able to do other things. Is that effective? Because you need to like inspire trust, but you also need to inspire that you can effectively translate what's happening, which is so critical to people then making other decisions.
Yeah, absolutely. And you you know, and you are informing in many organizations. You know, your job may be to inform a decision maker.
Right.
And if you're, you know, not providing them with a clear, articulable reason why they should or shouldn't do something, you're probably not, you know, they're not going to be happy about that one way or the other. And I think the other important thing about that is as you break down a decision-making process, you can find in there where maybe that went sideways a little bit, or why maybe that was the moment you missed opportunity, or you went left and you should have gone right. I mean, and it, you know, taking everything and being able to learn from it. And our line of work would debrief like crazy too, right? So almost every event, we all go back and, you know, we talk about what we experienced and why we did what we did, so that we can do it better next time.
And learn
from each other.
Okay, and then last is just, you know, I think you alluded to it a little bit, but I'm curious, as you think about young Kevin, you know, maybe even like high school, college Kevin, you know, and you see where you are now and some of the things that have served you well, or, you know, as you kind of evolved, what advice would you give yourself to make life a little bit easier, or to make the path not such a challenge?
Yeah, you know, I think that it's something that I'm trying to and will do more of in my two boys as they get older, but take a step back and see what this is all about. And the best way I can explain that is I remember when I was in high school, I would live this very narrow. I was a very straight-laced kid. Like, I didn't push limits in any way, but I, as I navigated school, I never really understood why it was even there. I never kind of like recognized, like, what's the next step? Oh, my dad's telling me military or college. Like, I don't even really kind of have, like, I felt like isolated in my own little world. And you know, I think maybe experiencing more, and maybe that's not common. Maybe you want most kids to kind of experience less, but I think really opening yourself up and to all different inputs and experiences, and really kind of seeing what motivates you or what doesn't. It could have just been a circumstances for me, you know, and my dad passed away, and maybe I kind of was like, oh, I just need to kind of do this one thing and not kind of pull back. And, you know, one thing I promised myself I'll do with my kids is in my line of work, and I mentioned it kind of with that story I told with the child, but as long as you're doing good and you're contributing to society, I'm not sure I really care what you do. You know,
right.
I mean, I want I don't want to limit my kids or in that you have to take this path in life or you have to do this. Like, soak it in. And as long as you're not, you know, doing anything that's criminal or hurting others, then maybe that's in the end what's most important. Don't want you living in my house forever, so we'll find something there. But, you know what I mean? To not be focused on something too early in life. Like, take as much of it in as you can, you know? Absorb as many different interests and experience those interests and you know, chase different dreams and see what kind of where you land, and not feel like, you know, life is one stage after the other, and that you have to, you know, this door, like, open a lot of doors and experience it. Because I feel like if I had to look back, maybe there were some missed opportunities, and I fell into this career and love every minute of it, but, you know, I certainly didn't get there in the most traditional way. And so maybe I would have found it earlier, which would have made a retirement sooner. But, you know, I think just just opening your eyes and ears to everything around you.
I think that being curious, and I think that transition of being told what to do, you know, as when you, that's 17, 18, 19, you know, you're transitioning from being, you're just, your path is carved out by what your parents deem to be the thing. And I think taking that ownership and agency, one of the things, we do some workshops with young kids, and I was working with a bunch of eighth graders and trying to teach them the concept of agency, maybe too advanced, but you know, you do have some agency. You can start at that age to sort of start to think about, who am I? What do I care about?
Yes,
what are my opinions? What are my thoughts? How do I, they have so much information now coming at them.
Yes.
Way more than we did.
That's a great way to put it. Maybe that you probably summed up better than I did, but that's exactly right. Yeah. I couldn't agree more with you.
Oh, well, thank you so much. This was amazing.
Thank you.
It's really
interesting. Thank you for the opportunity.
And I really appreciate like your honesty and just opening up about it.
Absolutely.
Really, thank you.
You bet.
Okay.
Thank you, Kevin, for coming on the show today, and thank you for your service. I enjoyed hearing about what it takes to make it through the academy, the value of teamwork, and how critical strong communication skills are when de-escalating a situation. Thank you to Missy for producing this episode and Hannah for your support. A big thank you to our relatable community. We continue to grow our audience and so appreciate all of our listeners who have stayed with us. If you enjoyed this conversation, please take a moment and subscribe either on YouTube or your favorite streaming platform. Relatable is sponsored by TFA Soft Skills, and you can find more information about Relatable and our sponsor by visiting www.tfasoftskills.com. Until next time, this is Teresa Freeman with Relatable. Stay connected.